From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Faith in America has always been a rolling target, from pilgrims at prayer to tent meetings to interfaith families, televangelists, and now a whole lot of wide-ranging seekers and beyond. A new Pew study lays it all out with startling clarity. Protestants no longer in the majority. More Americans leaving organized religion and affiliation behind, but not spirituality necessarily. We're trying to catch up. This hour on Point, Faith in America Now. You can join the conversation. Where has your faith life been moving? Are you one of the none of the above crowd now? Where does that take our culture? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will touch down in Kentucky for a preview of tonight's vice presidential debate. But joining me now from Washington is Gregory Smith, senior researcher at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life. He was lead researcher on the big news survey out Tuesday titled Nuns, N-O-N-E-S, on the Rise, as in none of the above. Gregory Smith, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Give us the big numbers. What have you found?
Well, what we found is that over the last 5 years or so, the number of Americans who describe themselves as religiously unaffiliated, atheists and agnostics, and those who say their religion is just nothing in particular, that group has really continued to grow at a rapid pace, to the point where today, 1 in 5 American adults is religiously unaffiliated. At the same time, we've continued to see a decline in the number of Americans describing themselves as Protestants. In fact, this year in 2012, for the first time in our polling, we're finding fewer than half of American adults describe themselves as Protestant.
You say for the first time in your polling, would that mean the first time in American history, if you look back? I mean, the country was Protestant majority from the beginning, given the way immigration and settlement worked, wasn't it?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. It's hard to know, you know, prior to the era of survey research, how people thought about their own religion, how they thought about religious belonging. But certainly this is a big shift, at least over the last several decades, during which time we've been conducting scientific surveys.
Of course, we do know our history, and we can read it. We'll look at that. So in terms of your survey era, what about Protestants? It's gone from what to what?
Well, from the early 70s all the way right through the early 1990s or so, surveys consistently found that 6 in 10 or more Americans, even as many as two-thirds, described themselves as Protestants. The percentage of Americans who are Protestant really began to decline in the early 90s, which was about the same time you began to see growth in the religiously unaffiliated, to the point where, as we've mentioned today, fewer than half of American adults are Protestant.
So let's look at the rest of the of those who do claim an affiliation. What else did you find in the survey, Catholic and so on?
Well, Catholics' numbers have been holding steady in recent decades at just about one quarter or so of the population. But what's interesting about Catholics is that even though their overall numbers have held steady, there are important changes underway within American Catholicism. Most notably, I think, the share of the population that are white non-Hispanic Catholics has been dropping, but the overall number of Catholics has held steady because of the influence of Hispanics and immigration, especially from Latin America.
So that means you've had Catholics also moving to unaffiliated, but those ranks being replenished in no small part by immigrants.
That's exactly right. Other work we've done shows that, you know, many Americans switch religions at some point in their lives. And in that process of religious switching, Catholicism loses more members than really any other group. In fact, there are 4 people who are former Catholics for every convert to Catholicism. And that's a ratio we really don't see for any other groups.
And what about your unaffiliated? That includes a pretty broad spectrum, from straight-up atheists, I think, if I read you correctly, Greg, to people who say, well, I'm not affiliated, but I believe in God.
That's exactly right. It's a very diverse group. Among the 20% or so of the public that is religiously unaffiliated, it includes atheists and agnostics. About 3 in 10 of this group identify themselves as atheists or agnostics. But the largest part of this group are not atheists or agnostics. It's people who say their religion is simply nothing in particular. And that group isn't necessarily irreligious. Many of them believe in God. About two-thirds, in fact, say they believe in God. Many of them describe themselves as religious or spiritual people. So we shouldn't assume that the religiously unaffiliated consists entirely of people who are secular in their outlook and worldview.
In fact, on the contrary, though it's not tightly defined, I mean, you show that sector growing from 15% to 20% of all U.S. adults in just a handful of years, and a much higher percentage, I guess, if we're looking forward here, perhaps, of course, they can always change their mind, but for American adults under 30, it reaches one-third that unaffiliated population. Is that right?
That's exactly right. We know that generational replacement is one of the key factors that are driving these changes in American religion. Young people today are both less affiliated than their elders, but importantly, they're even less affiliated compared with previous generations of young people. So this really is something new. The large numbers of young people in the United States today who are religiously unaffiliated really is something new in the American religious landscape.
You've got a third who classify themselves as spiritual but not religious, many who have dropped away from affiliation. What about religious attendance, practice?
Well, actually, religious attendance is one of the key distinguishing characteristics of the people who are religiously unaffiliated. You know, we've said that this group isn't entirely comprised of people who are secular. Many of them are believers. Many of them participate in various forms of religious activity, whether those be individual activities or as part of a group. But the one thing they really do not do very often at all is attend religious services. In fact, only about 5% of the religiously unaffiliated say they attend worship services regularly, and that sets them apart from many other groups.
Let's go back to Protestants for a moment, because a certain sector of Protestants have been very prominent in our national life, certainly political life in recent decades. Evangelical or fundamentalist Protestants have been big in televangelism, big in conservative circles. What about their numbers? Have they grown while mainline, what used to be called mainline Protestants, have decreased, or are they also down?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I think over the long term, research certainly suggests that the decline of Protestantism is concentrated among the mainline, the Protestant mainline.
It would have been Methodist, Episcopalian, Presbyterian. I don't know what else you include there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. However, what our data show is that over the short term, just in the last 5 years, we have seen a decline, a small but a significant decline, in the percentage of the population that's composed of white Protestants who describe themselves as evangelical. So even that group is showing evidence of decline in terms of their share of the population.
Do you have explanations for why Protestant numbers, those self-declared Protestant numbers, would be going down? What's pushed people away or drawn them elsewhere?
Well, you know, we've mentioned the importance of generational replacement in driving some of these trends. I'd say that's
And it's not happening,
factor.
You're saying.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Young people, older folks from these denominations are not being replaced by younger people. Younger mm-hmm. people are much more likely to be religiously unaffiliated. I'd also just point out that, the growth in the religious nuns could be seen as one among several indicators that the U.S. may be becoming gradually less religious. You know, over the last decade or so, we've seen a small but noticeable increase in the number of people saying they never attend religious services. We've also seen over the longer term a decline in the percentage of Americans who say they never doubt the existence of God. So there are a few indicators that suggest the U.S. may gradually becoming less religious. Not all indicators, and it's certainly not, it shouldn't be overstated, but there are some indications that the U.S. may be becoming less religious.
Your study also points to exactly that engagement of religion and politics in recent years as potentially something that's pushed some people away.
That's exactly right. Many scholars have pointed to that as one explanation for this trend. And, you know, one of the things you see in our data are that the religiously unaffiliated really are politically quite distinctive. In 2008, as a matter of fact, the religiously unaffiliated were as strongly supportive of Barack Obama as white evangelicals were supportive of John McCain. So that's an important political group, and I think that their cohesiveness is sometimes overlooked in our discussions of religion in American politics.
Do you look at these numbers as a one-way street? There's always been flux and change in Americans' relationship with religion over long periods of time. Perhaps there's a fall away, maybe there'll be a return, or do you see this as somehow an inexorable directionality to this?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen going forward, and it's exactly for the reason that you just mentioned. This is always a two-way street. We know that there are many Americans who were raised in a religion, either Protestantism or Catholicism or another faith, who have left, who have switched, who have become religiously unaffiliated. But we also know that there are many people who are raised religiously unaffiliated who later in life become associated with a religion. In fact, perhaps as many as half of people who are raised nothing later become something. So this is a two-way street.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Talking this hour about religious faith now in America. A little chanting behind me there from a Buddhist temple in Arizona. A new poll finds Protestants in the minority for the first time ever, and more Americans than ever checking none of the above, no affiliation. With us now from Dallas, Texas, is William Lawrence, Dean of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University and an ordained Methodist minister. Bill Lawrence, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks to you for letting me join you.
Wonderful to have you with us. And with me in the studio, big thinker extraordinaire on America's changing political and religious landscape, Robert Putnam, professor of public policy and American politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author of American Grace. Bob Putnam, welcome back to On Point as
Thanks
well.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Bill Lawrence, first to you, if I may, in Dallas. What do you make of these new numbers, sir?
Well, the numbers reported in the Pew study are consistent with the observations that those of us who look at church life can confirm by our own experience. One of the things that we see in the denomination of which I'm a part is a regional differentiation in the church affiliation, in the participation rate of people in worship attendance on a regular basis. All that, for example, peaked in the 1950s and nearly 1960 and has been really in a steady decline for the denomination since then.
Why do you think it was so high in the 1950s, 1960s? There's all kinds of waves through American life. And what do you think has led to this diminished numbers now, Bill?
Well, I think the issue of the 1950s was the phenomenon of the post-war experience in America. As the United States emerged from the experience of World War II, there was a great deal of recovery effort within the society and a lot of spiritual yearning. And we were also at a time when there were tremendous support systems in place for Protestant experiences, Protestant cultural life to be the norm in America. We have to realize that in the 1950s, people were yearning for some kind of spiritual home, some kind of national identity, and a sense of belonging. And all of the infrastructure that tended to be in place favored mainstream Protestant denominations. It was a time, for instance, when an institution that's tremendously important in the American landscape now, the National Football League, did not even exist with a national television contract. There were no youth programs that sponsored peewee football and soccer programs for kids that practiced and played games on Sunday mornings. And then there were blue laws that kept retail shops mostly shuttered on Sundays. All of those support systems have changed in American culture in the last 60 years.
In many ways, for many people, community was church or their faith community, whatever that might have been. Bob Putnam, what do you make of these new Pew Center numbers?
Well, as Bill says, they're entirely consistent with what the people who've been studying this over the last 10 or 15 years have found, and nobody disagrees about the numbers. Mm-hmm. The interesting questions are about change over time and about what to make of it, what's causing it. On the first point, if you look over time at the number of nones, that is these N-O-N-E-S, people who are not religiously affiliated,
kind of none of the above,
they've not been rising sort of steadily 1% a year forever. If you do the graph, it mm-hmm. looks like a hockey stick. That is, it's flat, and then beginning in 1990, it begins to rise quite sharply, and especially among young people beginning in 1990, there's a sharp increase. And as the Pew study shows, and our work shows too, about a third of all young people now are nones.
Which show none as in none of the above, which shows an accelerating trend here.
And we've been doing studies every couple of years, and it is literally accelerating. It's just going up every year now a couple of percent, not a couple of percent a decade, but a couple of percent a year.
None as in no religion. What's the why?
Well, there are two different groups that's important to keep distinct there. If you track individual people, as we're able to do in our research, you can see two different kinds of people in that category. I would say the people who mean it and the people who don't mean it. The people who mean it, that is, in the Pew study, those show up as the so-called atheists and agnostics. Mm-hmm. In their behavior, they really are secular. And that group has been rising. But actually, that's not where most of the growth is, in a different category,
Okay. Which
is people who are loosely attached to their religion. If you follow the same people,
right. They'll
tell you this year there are none, next year they'll tell you a something, and the year after that they'll back to a none. They're like a light bulb that's a little loose in its socket.
Okay.
So they're not quite clear whether they really are Catholic or not, Methodist or not.
Mm-hmm.
The jargon for these are liminal nones. That is, they're sort of on the edge of being nones.
Right.
That's the category that's rising most rapidly. And that category, both of these categories, the people who mean it and the people who don't quite mean it, are interesting to explore. And we think there are a number of hypotheses. As the Pew study says, as we review the literature, we think there are two main explanations. First, a generalized weakening of attachments to institutions and to tribes, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That is, and that's not just here. You see it in politics. This is exactly the equivalent of the rise of the independents, the people who are no longer neither Republican nor Democratic.
But we keep being told they're a tiny minority now, that everybody's in one camp or another.
No, but it's true that everybody's in one camp or other in terms of how they're going to vote for president, but they're not in one camp or another. They reject both camps in terms of the Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. They're what's called party identification.
Okay.
The number of people who say, actually, I'm neither Republican or Democrat. Mm-hmm. I may vote for, you know, Romney or Obama, but I'm not attached to that tribe.
So same effect here.
Exactly. The other part of it, and we think it's the most important part, is that this change is concentrated in the group of kids who came of age in the 1990s and afterwards. And what distinguishes them above all is that these kids who become nones, they are really opposed to mixing politics and religion. And so a large part of this, we think, if you get down into the details of the study, is these are people who, for their lives, in terms of the public rhetoric, being religious means being Republican and being homophobic and being, I'm not trying to defend those views, I'm saying that's what they think.
Just what it is.
And therefore, they're saying if to be religious means I've got to be Republican and homophobic, I'm out of here. And those are the people who are leaving attachment to organized religion, and maybe that is a way station to secularization. Now, I don't actually think in the long run this is going to continue uninterruptedly. That's a different question. But in the short run,
you're seeing some sort of backlash and withdrawal from that kind of highly judgmental, politicized religion that we've seen in recent years. William Loris, take us on a little tour of the inside, I don't know, the mind or soul of that none-of-the-above person. I mean, we're getting lots of response here online. And let me just read you one, because it goes along with what Bob just said. This is from one of our listeners online, writes, I used to go to church when my children were young. I sang in the choir, taught Sunday school. From what I see now, with the intertwining of politics, religion, creationism, money, and guns, I'm afraid to set foot in a church. She writes, I've seen videos of ministers telling people who to vote for, a video of Jerry Falwell's school telling little children that President Clinton was the devil. I'm back to where I started. Read the Bible at home and judge no one. Does that sound familiar to you, Bill?
Yes. It's the kind of response to some of the approaches that various religious groups, including certain churches, local congregations, and in some cases slices of denominational or even non-denominational constituencies have taken, where they attempt to mask the theological meaning of a very significant word like evangelical and paint it with a brush that says it's not only a word with a religious meaning, but it's also got a political attachment attachment to it. And therefore, to be an evangelical, one has to not only believe these things, but must also vote this way and take this view on a social position. I hear that all the time, and people reject that kind of thing. My response is that the church has probably done a very weak job in clinging to its ability to be an effective teaching entity in such important theological propositions as the word evangelical.
And, you know, and yet, I mean, you describe how community structures have changed, media structures have changed. We've got the internet and Facebook communities now. But I wonder about all that as a substitute for, I mean, I grew up deep in the church, but it was a very kind of loving community. It wasn't harsh. It was certainly, though, a dense web of community support and relationship. What happens to that, Bill, when you know, church and, I don't know, maybe synagogue affiliation, I'm not sure, but when those structures find less participation, what happens to community and support?
When those structures erode or become optional, people discover a variety of different ways that they can engage in spiritually meaningful activities without having to participate in any organized community life. If one can go online and read a daily devotion as opposed to showing up at daily Mass, mm-hmm. or showing up at Wednesday night Bible study, and one can do that from the comfort of one's home, it feels as if that's a perfectly viable option.
You're at a seminary. Is it all the same to you?
Is it all the same to me? Absolutely not. We believe in forming persons for leadership in Christian ministry here at Perkins School of Theology, but that has to be done in the life of a community of learning and faith. It can't be done by an individual sitting alone in a cubicle somewhere apart from a community. For one reason, there's a tremendous lack of diversity. If I am sitting alone with my own inner spirit, thinking whatever inner thoughts I have, how am I encountering persons of other ethnic constituencies, persons with theological opinions that challenge my own? How am I staying in touch with the scholarly questions that people are asking about biblical interpretation? Those kinds of activities have to happen in a community of faith and learning.
Bill Lawrence, Bob Putnam, let's go to our listeners. Janet in Auburn, Alabama. Thanks for calling, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comments are very similar to some things that have been voiced recently, but I can remember going to prayer meeting on the Wednesday following the 1980 presidential election in a little church up in Pennsylvania. And our elderly pastor, who I'm sure is in heaven now, made a comment that how he was so sure that God had intervened on behalf of our county when Reagan beat Carter. And that kind of was the beginning of, whoa, where are we going with this? And my husband and I both went to Houghton College, an evangelical college in New York, graduated there.
Mm-hmm.
Firm believers in the gospel and that, but when the affiliation and the name evangelical started to take on much more political than spiritual tones, we just hesitate to call ourselves evangelicals anymore because of that.
So where is your faith life now, your religious life, Janet? Is it personal? Is it personal? Do you have a church affiliation?
We are members of a tiny church here outside of Auburn, Alabama, that was actually built in the 1840s, United Methodist.
Mm-hmm.
I love the United Methodist Church, so thank you to the guy from Perkins there.
Okay.
My grandmother was one of the first ordained Wesleyan ministers in the country back in the early 1900s. So our faith is strong, but I think the church, because of it so closely being tied to a particular party, has turned off a lot of people in our kids and younger generation, and also many of the what we call the, I think the Church of God, the Church of Christ, and I don't mean denomination, but people who call themselves Christians, too caught up politically, and also rather than reaching out to the least, the last, and the lost, it's become the arrogant, the affluent, and the apathetic, that, you know, all the seeker churches and just trying to make people feel comfortable, and then the involvement and the enmeshment with politics has just turned people off. But
Janet, we've got it. You're very dialed in, and I think we've got that profile of a faith that's still strong, but with a changed complexion. Bob Putnam, you're nodding along as Janet reports in from Alabama there that she's kind of singing your tune.
Well, not my tune. It's she's representing
the
trends in the reality, right? I think looking forward, Tom, there's an interesting question, which is, will these trends continue sort of indefinitely? That would make us look more like Europe, that is a long-term secularization.
Which What's your goes guess? On forever. You've paid close
attention. No, my guess is that American religion has historically been quite, I want to say entrepreneurial, quite, I don't mean that in a bad sense. I mean reaching out to new ways to reach new new ways
if
to find new
tent,
souls.
If it takes a tent, put up a tent.
And
takes a,
Jesus said to his disciples, be fishers of men. Mm-hmm. There's this huge pool out there of nuns. Nobody's fishing in that pool. We know what kind of lures might be attractive. It would be more religion and less politics. So
N-O-N-E,
I suspect
nuns again, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I suspect that actually the creativity of the American religious institutional apparatus will lead more and more religious leaders trying to save souls to try to appeal to people more like Janet and to the millions of other younger people.
Bill Lawrence, do you see them back in the pews one day and the church is rocking full again right across the land? Or is there a different manifestation entirely coming in the internet age? I don't know.
Well, first of all, the image of the pew being filled again may be not only a matter of spirituality, religiosity, and theology. It may be a matter of architecture. New kinds of worship spaces are being created. I know the word pew is a metaphor, but I do think different kinds of church structures, organizational life, worship patterns, and so forth are responding exactly to the kind of thing Bob Putnam is talking about with the entrepreneurial spirit of American life. I'll mention one other thing. We had an interesting phenomenon in September of 2001 in the weeks immediately following the attacks on New York and the Pentagon and the plane crash in western Pennsylvania. There was an enormous influx of persons returning to churches looking for a spiritual center. Bob is better at the exact data than I, but my guess is that return to worship attendance lasted for perhaps a month at best. And then people return to their former patterns once the sense of immediate crisis ended. There is always the possibility that some kind of geopolitical, economic, or other kind of crisis is going to cause people to ask themselves spiritual questions that they are not currently inclined to ask.
History pushes people in all kinds of directions. Bob, can you picture it pushing away, you know, back into church community? Trial and trauma?
It's possible that could happen. Actually, the dean is exactly right. It lasted, the period he talked about lasted just about 4 to 6 weeks, and that's not going to sustain a church over the long run. Over the long run, if you're going to build churches, and I'm not sure, I think this is still up in the air. It depends on how the American religious firmament reacts to this really sharp increase. This is not the same old, same old. This has begun in the last 20 years, a big change.
Cogita verum adversum me, dedere linquas me, reunquam exaltentur. Capu circuitus eorum, labor labiorum ipsorum operiere.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about religious faith now in America. New poll, new survey finds Protestants in the minority for the first time ever and more Americans than ever checking none of the above, no affiliation. Robert Putnam joins us, author, co-author with David Campbell of American Grace. He's with us from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. William Lawrence is dean of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University, joins us from Dallas. We asked on Facebook, Bob, Bill, you know, why do you think the numbers are down? Why do you think this is happening? People, all kinds of answers. Margaret says, you know, getting smarter, busier, and traditional religion doesn't align with people's needs anymore, whatever those needs. John says, because people are sick and tired of being told what to think and feel. Max, he says, because of discrepancies in dogma. Carrie says cognitive dissonance is just uncomfortable. Jane, you know, says, look, I was raised Catholic, but now I meditate and do yoga. Dan says science. That's why. Simple as that. All kinds of answers. Mike in Omaha, Nebraska. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
You guys touched on so many different levels, especially, you know, alluding to politics, and there's a bigger picture, but it sounds like you want to stay with the personal and individual.
Okay.
I grew up, in Catholic school, I should say. But, you know, it just seemed very mystical to me, and it just didn't seem real. You know, there's kind of an invisible other world. And so, you know, in my progress and kind of wrestling with that over the years, kind of came down to more of a secular base where ethics are the guiding principles, and which I think is what most religions are trying to offer as a code of ethics
mm-hmm.
by which we can behave. And, you know, I think there's kind of, you know, understanding that people want meaning in their lives and people want to, you know, be treated well and know that they should treat others well.
Mike, are you finding those things, all of those things, including ethics, in religion now, in a religious community or not?
I attend a Unitarian church, and what I find there is that I'm one of many atheists in the church. So, but what we focus on is social justice, and you know that anyone you know in our church can believe as they wish. We don't argue with each other over whether it's right or wrong, whether you believe in a God or not.
It's a very tolerant setting. Mike, I appreciate your call from Omaha. I mean, Bill Lawrence, how about this issue of ethics and even social justice? The churches, religious communities beyond Christianity certainly have long, I mean, there's all kinds of issues attached to all of them. But politically, we know the difficulties in the history, but they've been vessels for ethical teaching. Almost to, you know, every single one. If we have less organized religion, fewer people in those communities, what happens to the teaching and transmission of ethics?
Well, let's take the example from the 1960s and primarily then, but in the years immediately after that, with the civil rights movement. As important and justice-driven as the issues were in the civil rights movement, I think it's fair to say that the movement would not have been successful without the support, generally speaking, of the religious communities and the church. And I don't narrow that simply to the Christian community, but mm-hmm. from the broadly defined religious communities in the United States.
Sure.
That's where the engine of support came for enormously important big ethical questions surrounding the issue of race. The question going forward is, what will be the foundation for certain ethical principles, codes of justice, and the like? How will people be able to articulate why a certain approach is more just?
Mm-hmm. What about that, Bob Putnam? Where does that sit in a society where people drift away from religion?
Well, I think it's absolutely right. I focus not so much on the theology because I'm not a theologian. I focus really more on the social and political implications.
And yet this comes exactly to those because ethics
yeah, they do, of course.
Are not entirely about theology either, though the theology has been a vessel for transmitting very often.
That's so true that it's hard to find a major social or political movement in American history that did not begin and have strong roots in the religious communities, and not just in faith, that is theologically
yes,
faith,
yes.
but also in the communities, that the religious communities. That was true of the civil rights movement, but it was also true of the abolition movement. It was true of the American Revolution itself. It was founded on...
Do we risk losing the impetus and organization to pursue social justice if we lose religious affiliation?
Well, I don't want to be in the business of trying to recruit people to religion, but I have to say, as a political scientist, but as a political scientist, America would be a very different place in terms of our social and political ability to adjust to change if we lacked those religious communities. It will become a very different place. And my sort of expectation is that the American religious community, American religious organized religion, mm-hmm. will respond to this crisis, I think, in a way that will bring people back into religious communities. But I can't be sure about that. We have to understand this period of the last 20 or 30 years mm-hmm. in which there's been such a tight relationship between the most visible part of organized religion and one particular political party. That's quite rare in American history. That's
between
not
fundamentalist Christians and the GOP.
That particular tight organizational linkage is not common in American history. And I think we're going to look back on this. Who knows what the history, mm-hmm. you know, what the future is going to bring? But I think mm-hmm. we're going to look back on this as a very odd period in which the relationship necessary relationship between mm-hmm. faith and public life got just too close for comfort, too close for many Americans in their religious beliefs. We're mm-hmm. looking today at the religious effects, mm-hmm. but also the Republican Party is paying a price. You can see this in the data. I'm not talking about who's going to win the election this mm-hmm. year. I'm talking about people rejecting the Republican Party because they think it's too tied to religion. That is the way
from
the system
sides,
is reacting, reacting to this unusual marriage of a particular party and organized religion.
Kate in Burlington, Vermont. Kate, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. In answer to your question, I'm definitely a seeker. I wanted to bring up a couple things. I know time mm-hmm. is running out.
Yeah.
Since 92, I've been a holistic health practitioner, and I've been a meditation coach. And mm-hmm. what I'm seeing is people becoming less religious, but actually more spiritual in terms of the awareness they have of their soul and their human potential and helping them, asking questions about their life purpose and so forth and so on. And secondly, since the 90s, the New Age movement was very big. It's the wellness industry is exploding now, and it's more like the Native American spirituality when people are looking at their relationship with nature.
Kate, let me ask you, if I may, because our time is short, let me just ask you on this point of ethics and social justice. We all know this phrase, this dynamic, less religious, more spiritual. But how does that, or does that come together in community? How does it work for social justice, for ethics? Is it just about two?
Absolutely. The people who, in Vermont especially, we have several spiritual communities working together, several groups of people that meet on a regular basis, even dealing with ecological issues.
Mm-hmm.
The two are becoming really intermeshed. But the last really important point I mm-hmm. wanted to make was mm-hmm. children, because what we're seeing is the children being born now have more of an incredible sense of this, that we are all one. There's a book called The Children of Now.
Just by being born? I mean, I don't know how that happens, Kate, but let us pick it up. Thanks for your call, Bill Lawrence. Less religious, more spiritual. Kate is very invested in this, and we all know the power that can be there, but how do you look at that shift in so many Americans' attitude toward faith?
Well, I appreciate the comments that Kate made, and I found particularly revealing her description of the situation in her home state of Vermont, where individual seekers are coming together to form communities so that they can engage in shared reflections on participation in practices mm-hmm. of nurturing of children, nurturing one another's approach to the ways in which this seeking for spiritual wholeness can be nurtured. Eventually, the religious response, whether one uses the word spiritual or perhaps a more bureaucratic term, the religious response is only going to happen if people find a way to connect with one another in community.
Where do you see the trend lines going? Just more and more disassociation, Bill? Or do you see at some point a boomerang here?
Well, I don't know if I can predict any kind of boomerang, but certainly in my observation and judgment, we're still in the period of highly individualized and atomized approaches to matters of spirituality and religious faith. The opportunities are simply too abundant right now for people to write, let alone read a tweet or a Facebook posting and make a personal, private, individual, religious, or spiritual judgment. But I see evidence, small evidence, but I think probably growing evidence, that this will ultimately be unsatisfying, and people are going to have to find one another again.
Bob Putnam, you said at the outset you think we're probably not headed for European-style profile ultimately, but what turns it around?
The only people that could turn it around are the religious organizations, religious leadership. If they don't respond to this crisis, then we are headed down that other path. Because there are signs of that creeping secularism. I just don't think it's yet set in stone the way it is by now in Europe. It's going to be very hard for Europe to turn things around there if they wanted to.
A nation of seekers, scientific, religious, and otherwise, looking for that new horizon. Robert Putnam, Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, co-author of Amazing Grace. Bob, thank you very much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
And William Lawrence, Dean of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University, joining us today from Dallas, Texas. Bill Lawrence, thank you so very much to you.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
In a moment, a look ahead to the VP debate tonight in Kentucky. This is On Point. Paul Ryan says he expects Joe Biden to come at me like a cannonball at tonight's Veep debate in Danville, Kentucky. After the president's lackluster performance in Denver, the vice presidential debate has soared in importance. Joining us now from Danville with a preview of the strategy on both sides is John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC and writer for the New York Times. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's going to be a fun night tonight.
Well, what are you expecting here? Everybody's tuned into this in a way I can't recall for a VP debate before because of last week's kind of a big headline, Romney steps up and President Obama not in the House. What are the hopes on each side for tonight, John?
When you have one ticket gaining a lot of momentum from the first presidential debate, it really becomes incumbent on the vice presidential candidates to either accelerate that or put a brake on it. And what Barack Obama and his team are looking for is for Joe Biden to try to halt that slide that the top of the ticket's been experiencing since Denver last week. I talked to Bob Dole, who's been through this a couple times, both at the top of the ticket, also as a vice presidential candidate. He said, I expect Joe Biden to come out swinging and not let up the whole time, and don't assume that he's going to make big gaps if you're a Republican, because he may have done some things when he was freelancing, but this is going to be a disciplined performance. From the Republican side, I think they've got a lot of confidence in Ryan because he's very fluent on policy. Even though he is young, he's somebody who is seen as an intellectual leader of the party, and I think is not quite as vulnerable as, say, Dan Quayle was when, or John Edwards even in 2004, when their counterparts, Lloyd Benson and Dick Cheney, who was then the vice president, cast them as kind of lightweights.
You know, we saw in Romney v. Obama, Mitt Romney prepared to go at the president very directly here. A lot of direct attacks directly addressing the president. President Obama sort of low-key on that front. What kind of strategy are you hearing or are people sussing out from each party on how Joe Biden may intend to go at Paul Ryan, and vice versa, how Paul Ryan may intend to go at the vice president?
Well, one thing I think we're not going to see is the prior strategy from the Obama campaign, which you could call it prevent defense if you like football, you could call it rope-a-dope if you like boxing, of simply trying to parry the other side's blows and stay above the fray. I think Biden needs to try to go after Ryan on the ticket's Medicare plans, on their tax plans, try to call out Romney for, in the view of Democrats, setting a much different tone in that debate last week than the substance of their policies would suggest. And I think if you're Ryan, what you want to try to do is make the case that Mitt Romney and I have new ideas, have an economic plan that is going to turn this economy around. Their plan hasn't worked, and it's time for change, which was, of course, the very effective argument Barack Obama used in 2008.
What about these two men? I mean, look at Joe Biden with us for a second. Look at Paul Ryan. As men, as public performers, how do you see Joe Biden's strengths, weaknesses in this matchup? And what about Paul Ryan's?
Joe Biden's strength is experience. He is a very tactile and street-smart politician. He's not the most verbally fluent, although he is intelligent and he knows a lot. He can trip over language sometimes, but he shouldn't be underestimated because he's been doing this for quite a while. He's run for president twice in addition to his vice presidential candidacy in 2008, so he's been around the block. Paul Ryan has a little more distant appeal. He's not as much of a backslapping kind of politician as Joe Biden is. But he's extremely intelligent, and he's much more ideological than Biden is. So he projects a sense of conviction, and that's why when he spoke before a huge national audience at the Republican convention, gave that acceptance speech for the vice presidential nomination, he came over very well for the American public. He and Romney need to make a leadership argument, and the one thing that we've seen, Tom, in the polls of what has benefited Mitt Romney and raised him up is people are seeing him as more of a leader than before. His favorables are rising, and Paul Ryan has to make sure he doesn't interfere with that process.
You know, what about age here? I mean, this is, after all, in addition to the debate over policy, this is potentially one of these guys a heartbeat away from the presidency. Does age work for or against Paul Ryan as the way he presents? What about Joe Biden on that front?
Well, we've seen this come up from time to time because it's no surprise that you tend to have vice presidents in office be somewhat older than the new guys coming up to replace them. So we all remember in 1988, it was an open race, but you had Dan Quayle, who was 41 years old, and Lloyd Benson, who was 67, and Quayle said, well, I had as much experience in the Congress as Kennedy, and Benson smacked him down with a you or no Jack Kennedy.
Yeah.
By the same token, Dick Cheney to John Edwards said, this person I've ever met you is on this debate stage today, suggesting Edwards was absent. I don't think Ryan is vulnerable in quite the same way as either of those other two men were because of his grounding in substance, and I think he's going to, the youth will disadvantage him in the eyes of some people who will say, hey, that's a young kid, maybe he's not ready to be president, but he's going to have to count on his performance to offset that impression.
John Harwood in Danville, Kentucky, where the vice presidential, well, the vice president and the challenger meet tonight in a more than usually important VP debate. John Harwood with CNBC and the New York Times, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.